Hey Riders, have you been spending small amounts on short-term classes, watching videos, and using up every possible opportunity for free feedback? Reworking the same pages over and over in your writing group? Are you starting to feel like you're stuck in one stage of the process? Maybe it's time to consider making a bigger investment in your career and working with an author accelerator book coach. No one can guarantee that you'll write a book that will snag an agent or excite an editor, but a coach can help you move forward, finish a book or proposal you're proud of, and approach the next stage of the process like a pro. I know it helped me. If that sounds like something you could use, visit www.authoraccelerator.com to get matched with a coach who can help you.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things. Fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, pitches, proposals. This is your weekly podcast about sitting your butt in the chair and getting your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation and lots of articles that are out there at The New Yorker. Oh, wouldn't that be so nice? Sorry, at The New York Times. At
lots
the
of articles.
I'm just going to just lie.
Right.
We're just going to speak it into existence.
Often said that there is no credential police. However, there are lines. But yeah. Spirit that
All
thing,
right.
Jess.
Okay.
Know, secret it in.
All right. New York Times, Atlantic, and the Washington Post, and who the heck knows? Maybe someday the New Yorker. Exactly. And you can find everything at jessicaleahy.com.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia. I am the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, as well as the forthcoming novel In Her Boots out this summer, and the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, which came from my work as the editor of the Motherlode Parenting section at the New York Times. And once I did contribute to the New Yorker, co-bylined, yeah. So, you know,
that
dreams,
was very exciting.
Dreams achieved.
That was extremely
it was
exciting.
Super, super duper exciting, in part because someone once told me I never, ever could. So, Jess, you can never do it. That'll make you do it.
Okay, that'll make me do it.
Works on
I'm
me.
I'm on it.
All right. Kids, we have a guest today. I'm super excited. So let me give you a little bit of a bio. So goes like this. Urban fantasy, paranormal romance, historicals, the occasional billionaire, and now a rom-com, complete with a cute graphic cover that tells you exactly who you'll be rooting for and what to expect. What do all these things have in common, besides being written by today's guest, Ceresia Glass? Two things. First, they are all, as she says on her website, tales of overcoming the odds to achieve love and acceptance, universal desires for everyone, no matter who or what they are. And second, they're all books readers want to read. Books, in other words, that will sell. So I heard Ceresia briefly on another podcast say that she and her agent had actually sat down and strategized about exactly that and really wanted to dive deeper in. So first, let me just welcome you. Hi, Ceresia. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
Oh, we're totally delighted. So I want to start with you giving our listeners a little bit of backstory. So tell us how you got into this game and maybe a little idea of what your first published work was.
Okay, let's see. I've been a lifelong reader. Started reading, as soon as I could string words together and understood what they meant. Cereal boxes, comic books, things like that is what I started reading. And then, of course, I started wondering what the characters were doing after I closed the book, even in second grade and stuff like that. So I just started writing little short stories in English class to kind of, just because I was curious. And then when here in Atlanta, when they had the first Martin Luther King holiday event, I wrote an essay called Living the Dream for that. And I won and I got to meet Coretta Scott King. And that's when I realized that, hey, my words can kind of have impact. So that's kind of cool. So let me try to write. 20 years after that is when I got my first break. I discovered that there were writing groups. There was a Georgia Romance Writers group local to me as I was working part-time in a bookstore, supporting my book buying habit. And they were a great group of people, invited me to a meeting, and I did back from there. So I finished a novel, and then I sold it like a couple of months later, which was very, very fast. And because I didn't have any under the bed books, I've been writing to deadline ever since.
It says possibly everything you need to know about my growing up in 90s Kansas, that I too once won a Martin Luther King essay contest. Cool. I am, as anyone who has seen a picture of me would know, white, and I don't think it was the greatest essay in the history of the world. I just sort of think, I don't know, I've always wondered if I was the only person who entered. Which would not be true in Atlanta, right. but yeah, so weird thing that we have in common that I don't actually publicize because it seems a little, I don't know, it's just strange. Yeah.
Can I just say that when we were young, it was not uncommon for there to be like 6 entries to this writing contest. I just inquired about a writing contest for young people that I thought would be like some small potatoes thing. 6,000 entries for this like $100 prize, $200 prize, writing contest. I was like, whoa, things have changed a little bit. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I am sure there were a lot of entries for one that involved meeting Coretta Scott King. Mine involved winning a t-shirt, I think.
Okay. Yeah, since it was the inaugural holiday, they bid it up very well.
That's amazing. So you sold the first book, and like you said, you didn't have anything in the drawer. So you had to start figuring out, all right, you know, what made this one sell, and what do I want to do next? Did you start right off with an agent, or did you sell the first book without an agent?
I sold the first book without an agent. It was to a small press. So when we went to the second contract, that's when I got an agent. So again, just kind of researching through the Georgia Romance Writers, and at that time RWA, I found an agent that I thought would be great. She's developmental editor at Random House, and decided to move on to representing authors. So at that time, you know, I was on my third book, so I figured that was exactly what I needed.
It makes it a little easier to get an agent,
right? So. And then since then, as my career and my writing skills grew and I ventured into other things, I had met Jenny at a writer's conference. Jenny Bent is my agent of the Bent Agency. I met her at a writing conference, I don't know how long ago, but in the bar. I just thought that she was very, very cool. And I introduced myself and was like, I don't have anything for you now, but I just think you're cool. Kept writing for small presses. And then when I got my, at that time, Big Six contract, I was like, hey, Jenny, I don't know if you remember me, but I've got this Big Six contract. Do you think you would like to represent me? And she's like, yes, I really like your, you know, I sent her what the story was about and samples. And she's like, I really like your voice. Yes, let's work together. And we've been together 14, 12, I can't remember how many years it's probably 12.
How many books?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 books. So yeah, just about a book a year. Wait, yes, it's about that. About 12 or 14 books. English rights, German rights, Polish rights. All that kind of good stuff. So we work well together. I love her a lot, and I'm glad that she's looking out for my career.
We actually had Jenny, we dragged Jenny is probably a better word for it, onto the podcast at like episode 6 or something.
Well, and I have really, to say, when she says dragged, literally, like her, I used to live across the street from Jenny. And so literally dragged her, got her, brought her across the street. Yeah, like episode 6. That's about when it was. So many years ago.
All of those things are true. And I will put a link to it in the show notes. And everyone can laugh listening to Baby S and Baby Jenny talk about, I don't even know what we talked about. It'd be kind of funny to go back and listen to that. So at what point would you say that you and Jenny sort of started strategizing around the question of what, I mean, did you approach it from a what do publishers want or what do readers want? And how did you tie that in, I guess, with what you yourself wanted to write?
Well, with the writers' conferences, we were able to have in-person meetings kind of once a year. And that was about the time that we would start developing, you know, I would tell her what I was interested in and see if there was things that I could develop pitches on or give to her as a pitch that she can then turn around and talk to publishers, editors about. So, and then of course we would have, you know, if we couldn't meet face-to-face, then there are kind of check-in emails where then that become phone calls and stuff where, you know, I would ask her what's going on, what's in the hot in the industry, what's coming up that she might know about, so that I could then see if my ideas kind of mesh with where the industry was going. Then there would be times where I would just like, here's what I'm thinking. Which of these do you think would be a good way to go? Which one should I concentrate on? Because she knows that I can easily scatter. I'm a Gemini. I've got two minds about everything. So, and probably four personalities in each of those two minds. So, I can topic hop or content hop, book hop, you know, very easily. So I just kind of give her, here's the verbal vomit of the things that I was thinking about. Pick which one you think I should work on, and I'll work on that one. And, you know, sometimes I'll recycle some other things that, you know, things that we had talked about before that probably wasn't, you know, I'd hate to say trendy, but kind of on the line of what publishers were looking for or could be looking for down the road. Because, you know, it's like right now they're buying this, but 6 months, a year from now, what are they going to be publishing? So I just kind of, so she knows that better than I do, even though I can go to conferences and they can talk about what they want. It's, you know, she is the one that has coffee with them, you know, have phone conversations with them. So she would get a better idea of not only what they want, but what would work for my voice and my tone and the things that I'm interested in. So that does make it a lot easier to write to market or write what people are looking for, write what people are selling and want to, and what readers want to buy. So, and sometimes my take on it can be kind of quirky. So, you know, I had this idea about a cosplay romance because I'm like, you know, I'm a geek. I like geeky stuff. Maybe I should try for a change to write about some of the geeky stuff that I'm interested in. I don't know if this is going to be marketable or not, but you know, we had with Berkeley had a right of first refusal on my next contemporary work. So I'm like, hey, Jenny, I've got this idea. It's kind of like, it's a cosplay romance. Well, what's that? You know, it's this people who, you know, think Dragon Con and Comic Con where people just dress up in costumes, but it's like a vocation for them. It's their thing that they love to do. It's their hobby. It's their passion. What if we do and then I start pulling in the tropes. So what if we do a fake dating cosplay romance, friends to lovers with only one bed? So those are the things that, you know, some of the things that editors like and things that they can instantly understand. So she's like, let's do that. And it's like, that sounds great. Even though people might not know what cosplay is or might not be interested in that, they'll be interested in friends to lovers, only one bed and fake dating. So I'm like, okay, let me put something together. And then it's like,
not to mention reality TV.
And reality TV, you're right.
Don't forget that one.
And P.S., those cosplay, there are those cosplay people out there. And they're like, and if you go to any sort of convention or if you go to Comic-Con, you know they line up for days and there are a lot of them. And so I love this thinking of, okay, I could possibly capture that audience. And then there's this slice of audience over here that loves Friends to Lovers. I love this idea that you can say, this isn't just one thing. How do we come at this from various angles? That's so brilliant.
Right. And so, and then of course the editor loved it. She's like, let's make it a rom-com. I'm like, I don't think I'm funny, but I guess I can be snarky till the end of days. So I kind of had a snarky, and then as I was writing, it's like, oh my God, these people are hilarious. So let me add some more stuff in there. So yeah, so that's how the current contract kind of evolved. So we just kind of, I pitched like three or four different ideas at her. And I even had, you know, when Children of Blood and Bone were really hot, I had this idea for a reimagined historical fantasy, teen fantasy that was kind of set in a, could have been ancient Egypt, but probably was more like ancient Moreau. But it was about these sisters who had magical powers, because, you know, I'm always, anything that's Egyptian influence, I'm going to always be there. And you can probably tell that by my backlist. So yeah, I thought that I could do that. So I sent her a sample. I did three chapters and kind of sent her pulls on that. And she's like, we're going to need to work on that a little bit later. So let's do some, what do you have for romance? So I sent her a couple of ideas. And then the one that had the most merit was ended up being the cosplay one.
When you say her, do you mean Jenny or do you mean
the editor? Sorry, Jenny. Okay. I'm sorry.
No, yes. That's perfect. Yeah.
So yeah, I because I can idea with the best, mm-hmm. with a lot of people. I can just come up with ideas to follow through. You know, that's a bit different. But yeah, so I come up with a couple of things that I'm interested in. Maybe write a sample chapter or at least a blurb about what it could be about. And then I send those to her. And then she will pick a couple that she thinks would be marketable. And then we kind of go back and forth in email, just kind of trying to flesh it out. She'll ask me questions about the story, and then I'll answer those questions and kind of put those in the synopsis and into the proposal, you know, just trying to figure out what are the hooks, like we said before. So yeah, that's pretty much how our process goes. So and, you know, we'll be going back to contract with Berkeley again. So now I've got to ideate a couple of more things so that we can get the next contract done.
This is so fascinating for me to listen to, because my style with my agent is very different than your style with your agent. So my style with my wonderful agent, Lori Abkemeyer, is that I like to have something really sort of developed and thought through and have some of it written out and all that sort of stuff before I ever talk to her. And I've always, and I wonder how flexible that relationship is. So like, you know, might it be because I have to do a ton of work before I ever get to the point where I ever can ever talk to her about something? But I love this idea of going, being able to go with your agent, go to your agent with, you know, like six different things. Especially when you're talking about fiction, this makes it a little bit easier, I think, to talk ideas before you like go out and do 6 months of research before you can ever have a conversation about something. But it feels very freeing to me anyway to have this idea of, oh, let's have a conversation about multiple ideas. Do any of these seem to have any kind of merit? And then I actually do have a question, which is, if you're sort of writing to market, the assumption is that, you know, there has to be there's a speed element there. Like, you know, Serena Bowen is our third co-host, and she writes so fast. She's so, like, she's out there with a couple of books a year. So does this put pressure on you when you're writing to market to feel like, oh, I've got to either get there first, get there in time, you know, hit it at the right moment? Sort of where are you with your thinking, and does that affect sort of how you write?
So with this, especially with the LoveCon, I wasn't necessarily writing to market, because was there a market for cosplay reality show romances? I don't think so. But I knew that rom-coms have been, you know, gaining, they wax and wane, but I figured that, you know, with the couple of years that we've gone through in the last few years, people were looking for something like funny and not the angsty stuff that I usually write. So I wanted to do something funny because I needed to lighten my own brain and, you know, bring some positive joy into my own life. So with this, it in writing to market, I would say that there are elements in the story that are kind of hot in the market with, you know, the friends to lovers, the fake dating, all of those are kind of almost eternal, but I think those are really have been very hot of late. So, you know, I come to Jenny with the ideas, and she, since it's basically, it's a collaboration for us. And I'm glad that we have that kind of relationship, because it doesn't hurt my feelings when my agent says, no, let's not do that. Cause I know that she's got our best interest and, in mind, and you know, the goal is to be successful at this. So I want to make sure that the ideas I present to her are going to be ideas that sell. And if the idea is not, I'm willing to go back to the drawing board and come up with something else.
So I wanted to ask about that. And I think it's fantastic. I mean, I love that you get to do this with Jenny, but a lot of our listeners don't have agents yet. And I feel like you're sort of going through this process of marrying something that you have enough of a passion for to write about for a solid year to something that you think readers are going to be interested in, which isn't exactly, you know, I writing to market is like can be a loaded way of approaching it, but it also isn't like, I was listening to Marlon James on a podcast the other day, and you know, I love him. I haven't read his latest yet, but he was just talking about like, well, you know, don't let anybody tell you how to write. You got to write from the heart. And I was thinking, well, yeah, all of that is true and great to hear. But on the other hand, if you want to reach people, sometimes you need to make some choices around what's going to reach people. And maybe you don't if you're Marlon James. So I guess as you're sort of going through this in your own head, how are you thinking about those choices?
So for me, I focus on those universal themes, because, mm-hmm. you know, I every book has a theme, and I think every writer has a theme, whether they're conscious of it or not. So for me, while the story blocks may, or you know, the contents may be different, the emotional arcs and basically the themes of the books are pulled from the same well for me, mm-hmm. because again, those stories of love and acceptance, regardless of who the characters are, that's kind of the underlying theme of all of the books, you know, meeting your tribe or your that one or that three or that two people who make you who you are, and accept you who you are as you are and love you as you are. But you also have this character growth as well as the relationship growth in it. So I think that, having those universal themes and identifying the universal themes that you're good at and that you love to do and making sure that you weave those into your storytelling, I think that that's how you can make, you can be consistent in your writing regardless of the window dressing that you put around it. The core is still the same. The core is what people are going to go for, and then they'll be curious about the extra decoration that you put on it, basically. So,
or maybe yeah. The other way around, like they come for the decoration, but they stay for the core.
Like, exactly. So yeah, you're right. Cause it's like, you know, oh, look at all of these truffles on top of this cake, mm-hmm. but it's a cheesecake. And oh my God, I love cheesecake, but I've never tried that kind of cheesecake. So let me give this a try and see if I like it. And then, you know, they become addicted. And that's great for me, because I like to pay for my internet. I like to eat. I like to, you know, those mm-hmm. kind of things. So yeah, I mean, it's a career, it's a job, it's artistry, but at the same time, it's work. And it's yeah. a career, and you want to be paid for your work. So yes, I'm going to write something that I think is marketable, because again, I like to live, and I want to keep on doing that and, you know, pad my retirement fund and maybe even quit my day job one day sooner than later. So yeah, I'm going to write something and Jenny's going to help me write something that's going to be marketable to a wide audience. And so again, that's where you focus on the tropes and then put your spin on those tropes. So that's kind of what I do. So I, you know, come up with this crazy idea, identify the tropes, and Jenny can help me identify the tropes. Mm-hmm. And then, so that way, yeah, she pulls on those tropes, and that's what she talks to the editor about. And if the editor is gung-ho for those tropes, because, you know, there are people who only read the fake dating books, or there's mm-hmm. people who just love the friends to lovers or the enemies to lovers, you know, and that's like all they read. So if I can, you know, tap into those kind of audiences, like you said, in a broad way, I can get the friends to lovers, I can get the fake dating readers, I can get the only one dead readers, you know, all of that stuff. And, you know, the reality TV readers. So all of that kind of stuff.
When competition, the competition readers, I mean, then you've got that going too, because in the LoveCon, which we haven't talked about very much specifically, but that's the name of your latest rom-com, that's what you've got, is a woman who's the underdog in a cosplay competition, who has to bring in a romantic partner in order to compete in the next level and in a reality TV show, and brings in her best friend, who's never been her romantic partner. And, yeah.
Exactly.
All of the tropes ensue gloriously, and we love them for it. So it sounds, when you talk about what Jenny does with the editor, as though she is going to the editor without a completed manuscript. And I would love to hear a little more about how that is working for you, because that's a little different than what most of our guests have experienced.
Yeah, there's a lot of stress on that. But yeah, we've been in the game long enough where I can sell on proposal, which mm-hmm. is basically a detailed synopsis and the first three chapters or so like that. And that works because I don't want to devote a whole, you know, 365 pages or 90,000 words to a project that she doesn't think she can sell. So, or that editors aren't interested in. And then I've wasted, you know, a year mm-hmm. on something mm-hmm. that I can't sell. So writing on proposal works best, because then I can see if the idea has merit and if the editors are interested in it. And if they're not interested in it, then I'll just go and work on the next project. So then of course, if they are interested in it, now I've got to turn around and finish writing those other 22 chapters, which, you know, would be good if I were a plotter. I'm a pantser. So even though I have the synopsis and I have a general outline of it, the what I call the meat and potatoes of the story still have to be written out. I know the turning points and I can write to those turning points, but it's the, did they go out to dinner first, or did, you know, what kind of conversation did they have after when she got home? You know, those kind of things right. are things that you have to layer.
Are we going to have a scene in the taxi between the airport and the apartment, or are we going to go straight from the airport to the apartment and just let the taxi be? Yeah.
Right. So yeah, there's a lot. Yeah. We'll just assume that this happened, and now we're going to cut to where they're talking about this, you know, those kind of things. So that kind of turns in the story are take a little more time to get to. So I can write the beginning, the middle, and the end, because, you know, it, and those major plot points, because, you know, those are, I hate to say easier, but they kind of are easier, because those are the turns that, you know, drive the story. So the stuff leading up to that turn and then down from that turn to go back up to the next turn, that's where you got to do the work. That's the trench work, so to speak.
Do you ever find yourself with a proposal that and your book's not going in the same direction as the proposal did?
Yes, that happens quite a lot.
It happens in nonfiction too.
Because again, I'm that pantser and not a plotter, so I don't write to what the synopsis says. I write to how the characters are acting and interacting. So sometimes they will, as I'm writing them, they'll say something that's like, okay, let's expand on this. You mentioned this just in passing, but no, I think that's kind of important, so we need to expand on that. So especially in the LoveCon, there are things that Kenya experiences. There are microaggressions, because, you know, she's a Black plus size woman in a fandom that's not necessarily welcoming at times to that kind of body type or physicality. So
and one that is very physicality focused.
Yes.
Because it's about costuming and it's about appearances. So yeah, there's a need to embrace an appearance, and it's different than it might be if it was like a baking competition or
right.
And especially a home decorating competition, maybe right. That would be a better example.
And if you're looking through the cosplay tag on Instagram, you're gonna see there's quite a few people who do not look like Kenya in shape, who are, you know, it's it's ruled by the slender folks. And that's perfectly all right. But, you know, there are plus size people out there that are doing cosplaying some of their favorite characters who are not necessarily plus size. So, you know, and I think that that's great. And I just kind of wanted to champion them as well. You know, so the book is kind of a love story to cosplay, which I love, and I just love to people watch people, but it's also to those people who might not fit the standard type who love to cosplay. That was another thing about the story, because it's easy to write a story with a heroine who is conscious of her size all the time. And she's thinking about it as she's eating. She's thinking about it as she's buying clothes. She's thinking about it as she's with her love interest. And I just did not want any of that. Cause you know, I'm of a certain age where I don't care very much about people's opinions in that way. So I really wanted to write a heroine who is comfortable in her skin and celebrates and accentuates her features because, you know, she loves herself.
Well, it's an interesting balance that you have had to strike there, which is sort of between I am aware of how other people are perceiving me in this world, and probably for most people of different bodying sizes, I have gone through my own stuff to come to acceptance around what I, you know, who I am. So there's very few people who don't have that in their history. So it's really interesting to watch you strike the balance between, yeah, I've been there. Like I know that. And I know that other people are sometimes expecting me to still be there, but I'm not there anymore. I feel like that just, you know, we were talking a little bit about trends and writing to market, and there've been a fair number of plus-sized heroines lately, and they have really progressed from desperately trying not to be the size they're trying to make themselves smaller and often succeeding as like the victory of the book that takes us back to those 90s we were talking about earlier,
right?
To like maybe progressing to bodily acceptance and now to already being there and having a different story. So you're on that I'm there, this is a different story end of it, which is really interesting and also kind of like, it is a little on trend without necessarily being like, I'm on trend. People like books about vampires, so I'm writing a book about vampires. It's not that.
Can I just note also, I just went to your Twitter feed, by the way, and your pinned tweet is brilliant. Let me just explain why it's so brilliant, because we've been talking so much about, you know, talking to your agent about, you know, which maybe what tropes this hits and how you're going to thin slice, you know, a trope with a whatever. So your pinned tweet is the LoveCon is out now. This hashtag rom-com, well done, has fake dating, friends to lovers, secret pining, sharing a bed, black girl magic, cosplay reality show competition, gummy worms, a stress relief. That, my writer friends, is a really good pinned tweet, because you're showing there's so many ways to enter into that book with interest. Like, I may not care about, you know, the secret pining, but another angle on that may be my thing. And that is a really good, as someone who loves to look at tweets about someone, about how you tweet about your own work, that's really well done. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. It took me a minute, but then I'm like, you know, I know the story. I know how the story goes, but how do I encapsulate that in a tweet? You know, how do I tell somebody what it's about without going into this detailed, you know, basically a synopsis of the book? So yeah, so I just came up with those bullet points.
Well, it's like an elevated elevator pitch, but it's also a way to connect really deeply in the moment with, oh, you like this? How about this? I love shortcuts to that conversation. It's really well done.
Yeah, and that's something that Serena taught, I think, both of us. But
yeah,
I always sort of make a list of, you know, what to expect in this book that I think is going to contain the elements that are things like, and we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, that as a reader, it's really smart to sit down and say, all right, well, what are the things that, you know, what made me pick this up? And the answer is maybe reality TV, and maybe it's fake dating. Fake dating totally gets me. Maybe it's power differential, but not done in a scary way. So, you know, billionaire assistant sort of stuff, but with some awareness of how that works and all that stuff. And we talk about that a lot. So I love it when authors of every genre pull those things out and list them, because they're still, I mean, I'm reading a work of literary fiction right now that I'm going to talk about at another point on the podcast, so I'm not going to call it out, but, you know, it actually had, wedding planner, some dating stuff, a family thing. Like, they were a list that could easily have been on that list, and it's literary fiction, and I was like, well, that's actually why I'm here. I'm finding the literary bits a little challenging, but I'm here for the wedding planning. So, anyway, I'm holding and waving this book called Seven Figure Fiction by Theodora Taylor. And we had her as a guest earlier on the podcast. Have you seen this one?
She's awesome.
She is awesome.
And I've taken a couple of webinars of hers, interact with her quite a lot. And yes.
This is all about putting the butter in your book. And that's, you know, the butter is the two people, one bed. And I think she differentiates, that's like the, I don't remember if she calls that butter or
yeah,
what.
It's what she calls it. It's something fantasy.
Universal fantasy. That's what
universal fantasy. Thank you.
Yeah. So she wants, like, you make a list of the universal fantasy and then the things that make that, you know, so she'll say the universal fantasy I'm pulling out is Beauty and the Beast. But the thing that makes that butter is that the person who's mean to everyone else really likes you. That works for me too. So yeah, she's fantastic. And I think what's great about this is it works, you know, it's great for genre fiction. It's great for rom-com. It's great for literary fiction. It's really great for everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, I was saying things, but basically those universal fantasies are things that people can instantly get and understand. I mean, Beauty and the Beast, we've seen every, you know, people know every incarnation of that, you know, whether it's the cartoon, the TV series, I'm dating myself, you know, and in all of the movie interpretations of that, where it's not necessarily the based on the fairy tale. Oh, even the fairy tale. So yeah, so everybody understands instantly what that's going to be about and know who they should root for, or know basically what's going to happen in that
yeah.
story.
Well, I've been talking about the MAME story lately, the anti-MAME, which is, you know, dedicated non-parent is suddenly stuck with kids. That's a trope. That's a story. Like, I can find you a bazillion iterations of that, from the literary to the musical. The Gunkle is that. Anti-MAME is that. I mean, it's just over. I know you can find mysteries. You can find paranormals. You can find fantasies. People are sort of fascinated by that. I didn't think I wanted this, but now I'm going to do it. Thing. So, I don't know. We flaked a little bit off of our topic, but we had a good time. So let's have a little bit of a pause and then talk about which things we've been reading that fit into these worlds. All right, Sarisia, we love it when our guests go first. So tell us something you have read and loved lately.
Oh, lately?
Or it doesn't have to be lately. Yeah. Whatever. Okay. Whatever works for you.
Okay, well, I don't know about other people, but when I'm on deadline and I'm down to the finish line, I do not read because I'm focused on getting the words down. But something that there's two books that I have started reading lately that I really love. One is Island Queen by Vanessa Riley, and the other is The Dating Playbook by Farrah Shan. I love, which are two totally different things. One is a historical fiction, and the other is a contemporary romance, which again, I'm a Gemini, two sides of the brain. Both of those are get satisfied with these books. But I love them for different reasons. The Dating Playbook is the second in series. It centers around a group of friends and their loves and trials and stuff. So I really like reading about the camaraderie between the ladies and how they live their lives. And, you know, everything's not roses for everybody, but, you know, they're still coming together. Their friendship is strong and they support each other. So I really like that. And Island Queen is based on a true historical figure, Dorothy Kerwin, and I can't think of her last name, but who's from this island, and it's about her journey and how she became a self-made person, despite the odds and despite the time period. So I really like, in that way, reading fictionalized events of real people. And it's just a fascinating look, and how Vanessa brings this story to life is just really interesting to me. You can tell that she did a lot of research into it, but it turns that research into something that's highly readable and entertaining. So both of those books are ones that I really like right now.
I love it when a historical does that. Like Beverly Jenkins really pulls you into this whole different world that you didn't know about, but you don't even realize now that you're learning things that you didn't know.
Right.
Because you're also getting, you know, a juicy story about whatever, you know, a badass woman in the woods who's tougher than any of the men around her. And don't we all love that? Yeah, I was just looking up because I read Farah Roshan's first book, The Boyfriend Project, but I haven't read the Dating Playbook yet, so I will have to look for that. So I just finished The Sweetest Remedy, and I will pull up the author and put her in the show notes because I don't remember, but it's kind of interesting. So earlier in last year I read Sankofa, which was a story of a biracial woman who was raised by her white mother in London and discovered that her father was not just the leader of not just a black man, but the actual despotic leader of a small African nation. I don't know if that's how you say despotic, but that's how you spell it. And that was, I was like, oh God, I want to, you know, I'm totally there for that. And it was a very, it was both literary and fun and entertaining, and I really enjoyed it. And in some ways, The Sweetest Remedy was another variation on a similar thing. In that one, is she biracial? I don't even remember because it didn't remember. But the important thing is that her father was from Africa and was like a super wealthy man, but he had hidden her from her four half-siblings. And now she was going to appear in their life while his will was read. So, you know, all the juiciness there because he's gone and she has all this stuff about him abandoning her. But it had many similarities. And I was thinking, man, if you were the author of The Sweetest Remedy, when you saw Sankofa, you'd probably be like, oh, that's my book. But it doesn't matter. Sankofa was a Reese's pick. The Sweetest Remedy was a book of the month. Nobody is ever like, oh no, I've already read one book about somebody discovering their secret wealthy father. I don't want to read anymore. No, that's not the way life works. Bring on exactly. All the secret wealthy fathers. Please, I would like to read about them. So that's mine. How about you, Jess? What have you been reading lately?
I circled back to a book that has been not only in a stack next to my bed, but in my audiobook queue, and that's Julie Clam's The Almost Legendary Morris Sisters. And I think, speaking of secret fathers and secret family things, so I've been thinking a lot lately about sort of those stories that get told in your family over and over and over again, as authors are wont to do. We're like, ooh, which stories can I mine for my own personal benefit? And thinking about some of those stories, not actually when you look at the details of them being, they didn't go down the way that actually the family tends to tell those stories. And Julie Clam's book is so fascinating because there is a family legend about the legendary, or as she calls them, the almost legendary Morris sisters, because the story in her family is that the Morris sisters were these incredible women, and they, you know, they had relationships with these very powerful men, and they were very strong women in their own right who did things that women didn't do at that time. And it became this sort of self-perpetuating mythology. Some of it's true, some of it's very not true, but it's almost beside the point. What's interesting is the story about how a family member or a story that happens in your family gets mythologized and takes on a life of its own. And so I'm reading this book partially because I'm thinking about my own stuff, but I also love that someone who tends to do journalism comes at a family, their own family story and the people in their own family. It's a really, really fun book. I'm liking it a lot. So highly recommend. Plus, I liked her book, the one about the stars in her eyes. I can't remember what it's called. The stars in her eyes. And it's about her time interviewing celebrities. And it was sort of juicy and fun to read. And I like Julie Klamm's work a lot. So I'm really enjoying this one.
Oh, awesome.
I like this. The celebrity thing is another of the tropes that gets me. I just love talking about the things that really suck us in as readers. In part because I think that as writers, especially if we're worried about being taken seriously, we are often like, well, I can't write a book about, you know, somebody raised by their single mother discovering their wealthy father because that's been done. And please, you know, that's been done. You know what else has been done? Sisters on Nantucket. You know what else has been done? Reality television. You know what else has been done? Everything.
Right. But we and I'd like to just point out one of the most popular things in the going right now is true crime podcasts. And one out of every three true crime podcasts is that person isn't who I thought they would be. You know, that kind of story. And it's that's the most popular.
We're fascinated
genre
by that.
Exactly.
Yep.
I love it. All right. Well, this was super fun. And Ceresia, I want to say thank you so much. Listeners, you can find Ceresia at her website. The link will be in the show notes, but it's Ceresia Glass. Do you hang out on... we're going to put your Twitter in the show notes.
Absolutely. It's a good feed. I was just going through it.
More of an Instagram girl. Tell us where to find you.
Yeah, I do hang out on Instagram and Twitter a lot. Twitter's probably where I am the most, because, you know, I don't like to take pictures of myself. I'll probably put pictures of my dog or especially the junior assistant who likes to eat my carpet. You know, so there's pictures of her out there. So, yeah, I'm on Instagram at Ceresia Glass and Twitter is at Ceresia.
Easy to find. All right. Well, thank you so much. Listeners, if you want to follow us, best place to find us is in our Facebook group still. That is Am Writing Podcast on Facebook. You can email us, amwriting@substack.com, especially if you've got a question or something you'd like us to coach you through at some point in the relatively near future. And that's us, and that's where you find us. Jess, take us out.
All right, everyone. Tons of food for thought this week. Thank you so much. And until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop. Stall.